The introduction to this session here that we'll be discussing the psychological aspects of substitute decision making, I want to read to you a fascinating comment in the chat, which I think sets the stage for this. And it says as follows. It comes from Lauren Blatt. I wish that everyone could spend time in an intensive care. You would develop empathy for the suffering patient where when care becomes futile. Those of us who have ever been healthcare professionals in ICU have a DNR in our living wills. I want to thank Lauren Blatt for that tremendous comment. That is the stage that we want to talk about. In other words, there is so much that we talk about the patient. There is so much more to be spoken to about the people surrounding the patient. So all of these decisions that have to be made by SDMs, we speak about them very lightly. So the impact, and many papers have been written on what is the impact on the people that have to make these decisions and how they live with these decisions. And sometimes these are sometimes neglected in the big picture of what is happening. So we thought we wanted to address this. And of course, to address this topic, we reached out to Dr. David Pelkovitz, who is a noted psychologist. He is the go-to psychologist, I would say. I hope I'm not embarrassing him, but he is for sure in the community that the Yeshiva University and in broader terms, when there are some major challenges, they call Dr. Pelkovitz. And we've had the pleasure at the Torah in Motion to have Dr. Pelkovitz, and his stories, our clinical scenarios are mind-boggling, and they resonate. And I'll let him do his presentation, but it's really a great honor and a privilege. Dr. Pelkovitz holds the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Chair in Psychology and Jewish Education at Yeshiva University's Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration. He is also a special assistant to the president. He has served for two decades as the director of psychology at North Shore University Hospital, NYU. He is a noted author, more importantly, I believe he is really a tremendous representative for our community and speaks so highly in terms of these difficult situations. So without further ado, it's my pleasure and my honor to invite Dr. David Pelkovitz to speak to us about psychological aspects of substitute decision-making. Dr. Pelkovitz.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I had seen that comment and it resonated with me. Almost everybody I know who spends a lot of time in ICUs it changes their views on making sure that there's very a lot of clarity about substitute decision making.
So why don't you eat lunch?
Yeah, we just need to get somebody muted. Okay, thanks. Okay, so let me just go here with that. Interestingly, though, by the way, in terms of a counterpoint to that, and I don't pretend to have the answer to this, there is some research that shows that when people come to the point, people who have DNRs and have made careful planning for substitute decision-making, when they come to that point in terms of the end of their life, when they were certain that they would want to not be resuscitated, they'd want to activate a DNR and, you know, all the protocols that we've been talking about today, many of them will find more quality of life at that point and report surprisingly high levels of something to latch onto in terms of finding meaning. And I don't think this is a black and white thing. I think it's there's truth in both of those perspectives. But anyway, that's what was running through my mind when I saw that comment. This is a comment coming from somebody who's speaking from deep experience, and virtually every person I know with that kind of deep experience comes to the same conclusion. But then there's this other layer to it. Okay, so let me get going with this. There are no conflicts here.
Can everybody see the presentation?
You're able to see it now?
Yeah, okay. So you tell me when you want me to click the next slide and I'll do it for you.
It looks like I might have control over it now. Like when I'll click to slide five.
I took away co-host and I redid it again. So maybe there was something.
Oh, great. So
maybe
it should be okay work now. I think okay. I have control over it now.
So,
is that okay?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, good. So this is almost exactly echoing what we just heard in the brilliant talk from Rabbi Dr. Steinberg. Engaging with substitute decision makers at a time when things are relatively stable facilitates planning according to previously held values, right? The reality is that those conversations are very hard to implement when confronted with choices. It's hard to maintain the clarity of thinking at such times. And the kind of clarity, there's this concept that I've spoken about at other conferences about ethical fading, that we may be pretty certain that we know what to do in certain ethically challenging situations, but as soon as we're in it, especially in dealing with end of life issues, a lot of confusion could settle in. And it becomes much harder to do. I'm reminded of a number of times in my own family when, we had a lot of clarity and it was a family where all of the children had tremendous clarity about how to proceed. And we'd had many discussions and we were all working beautifully together as substitute decision makers. But then when push came to shove and there were decisions to be made about something as basic as, injecting morphine at the end of life with rabbinic guidance and with medical guidance at a very high level, it became, even with that, very hard to think clearly. And it was there's a confusion that I think is often normative in situations like that. So, for example, there's at any kind of transition point, especially in dealing with these kind of things, there's a tremendous amount of fuzziness of thinking. And if we look a little bit at the, let me just go here. The strong feelings about death. I don't think I'm saying anything here that's at all surprising. You know, anytime we're dealing with, end of life issues, we're forced to confront our own mortality. That's fascinating research with even little children at a very young age. They start to show high levels of physiologic arousal and anxiety when we measure the physiologic correlates of stress, even in little preschoolers. Okay, it forces us to confront the narrow bridge we're all living on, the fear of the unknown, feelings of helplessness. And that's just a natural kind of reaction to a death. Let me share with you a story. Since
Dr. Pelkowitz. Dr. Pelkowitz. I don't think that you're sharing your screen. I think it's coming off mine. So I just want to be in sync with your presentation.
Oh, what? Okay. So, because I thought it was, it seems.
Yeah, it's weird. Not. It's coming on.
Fine. So you're in charge.
What slide would you like?
I'm on slide six.
What is the, is it reality?
Reality very different than theory.
Okay, so that's where we are now. You should be able to see that as well on your side. And I think the audience now sees it as well. Reality very different than theory.
Yeah, I apologize for that. Okay, fine.
All right, sorry.
So here's just the reality, you know, in a very widely cited study in Lancet, they found that if a patient prepared an advance directive, most don't know where they are most doctors don't know they exist or what's in them. They found that about 40% of hospitalized patients, this isn't surprising in terms of everything we've just been hearing, lack the mental capacity to make decisions because they were unconscious, delirious, demented, or had other cognitive impairment. And that, in fact, when you look at what are surrogates basing their judgments on, it's considerations other than what the patient wants. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so, you know, what's usually recommended using, you know, using the general guidelines in terms of, you know, medical ethics, you know, patient-centered decisions, it's called, they call it substituted judgment. So it focuses on the sick person's wishes and interests. It's based on recalling past conversation of what the person wanted or general knowledge of the person. You know, based on the guiding question, if the patients were sitting in the room with you, what would they want? Okay. What's in their best interest? Okay. But it's hard to do because patients are almost always imagining a reality that's different with that's different from what they were talking about. Okay, next slide, please. Okay. Let me go to a story because I think it's one of the stories that was flashing through my head in terms of what Rabbi Dr. Steinberg was talking about before about you know, certain growth that could come even at times like the you know, that decision, that very, to me, horrifying decision made you know, made in that decision that just came down today. So it's the story of a organization that had been inviting me to speak there for, they've been begging me to come. So Chassidus organization that worked with severely cognitively and physically impaired kids, like very, very severe. The level of stress on the parents was unbelievable. And it was a group of Hasidim who I had a certain bias, totally unfairly, against them. They kept begging me to come for Shabbos, and I kept imagining feeling totally out of place. You know, here I'm wearing this kind of yarmulke, and I'm a YU guy, and it just didn't feel right. And I didn't want to subject myself and my family to a Shabbos with people who I was sure were going to view me as a sheikis. And in fact, one of them referred to me as Hasidei Umos HaOlam. You know, they viewed me as a righteous Gentile. And they meant it in only the nicest kind of way. So after nudging me, I think at least once every couple of months for 5 years, I finally relented. I said, okay, I'll come. And I came. And of course, it was the most amazing Shabbos I have ever had in my life. And there was the guy who was in charge of the Shabbos was extremely persistent getting me to come. After we had the tish, it's Friday night. We sit down. It's about 3 o'clock in the morning. We were in a beautiful hotel. And he says, do you mind that my wife and I meet with you? So we go into the corner of the lobby of this hotel. And he tells me, I have a daughter who was born 8 years ago. She was incredibly cognitively and physically impaired. We were told she'll never walk, she'll never talk, she'll never understand. She had absolutely, you know, nothing but a life of suffering and pain and emptiness ahead of her. He said, but I heard when she was about 2-3 years old, that there was an experimental treatment in Europe for this kind of spinal stenosis, because she was never able to sit up. That was part of the problem. But for this kind of disorder, where certain people respond, and if she's given a successful treatment, there's a chance that she'll be able to sit down. You know, that she'll be able to learn how to sit in a wheelchair. He said, to me, that was worth anything. For her to be able to spend her life looking at people, kamayma punim el punim, right? Eye to eye, face to face, heart to heart. I thought it was worthwhile. So he arranges to go to Europe. He goes to Europe and they start working on her. And it turns out she's a responder. And he's there for a number of months. And he tells them, listen, I have a lot of other kids back home. Please teach me how to do this therapy. I need to learn how to do this therapy because I want to be able to go home. And my family can't wait for me and I have financial pressures. Just teach me how to do it. And they tell him, look, you told us you only have a third grade secular education. The rest of your education is more in Jewish learning. They said, you can't possibly learn. You just don't have to have the basic understanding of anatomy. He drove them crazy and they finally agreed to teach him. So then he comes to the point of the story. He tells me, do you mind if I introduce you to my daughter? And we call to a counselor at the other end of the hotel lobby and they wheel over this clearly impaired, now 8-year-old girl, who's clearly, totally and utterly, you know, out of it cognitively, but she's sitting up and she looks at us as they wheel her over to us and she flashes her parents and me a $1 million smile that we meet with tears of joy. Since then, I say the bracha of Zokev Kafufim totally differently than I ever did. It just shifted. It shifted my perspective of what that's all about. It shifted my perspective of how to view the value. To me, that's the ultimate answer to many of the, to me, misplaced kinds of thinking that Rabbi Dr. Steinberg was talking about. So that's just that. Is that responsive a little bit to what we're talking about? Hello? Okay. Okay, everybody's in Zoom mode. Okay. So the idea here is substituted judgment. There the idea is that what we talked about this already. Next slide, please. Okay. And so let's say you're trying to figure out what to do as a substitute decision maker, and you decide to do something a little bit differently than what you had discussed with your parents when they were able to really talk this over with you, and you decide to do something a little bit different. It's not that you're denying what the person wanted. It's you think the person would have made different decisions if they understood the facts better. That's all part of this complexity. Let's keep going. Next slide, please. Okay. There's also another model that's often talked about in the psychological literature on substitute decision-making at the end of life is more surrogate-centered, which involve a different set of factors. It might be based on sort of that golden rule that was discussed earlier. It's more likely to be guided by people's religious beliefs, which might be accepting death or fighting against it. But it's not necessarily coming from what the person, when they were alive, said they wanted. This is more surrogate-centered. It's much more subjective and not necessarily at all in keeping with what we've had drummed into our heads in terms of what guides ethical decision-making at the end of life. Let's keep going. So now I wanted to get into this in terms of going into it a little bit of a deeper level. Let's talk first of all about sources of family conflict. I want to dig a little bit deeper here. Okay, so in a community survey that we did, where we looked at a large number of people in the modern, or I'm sorry, in the Orthodox Jewish world, it was a selected sample because it was people who had access to internet, but it was a wide range of people in the Orthodox community. And, you know, we found that frequent sources of conflict in most Orthodox Jewish marriages are around areas of communication, lack of time, money, in-laws was up there, sexuality, the work-life balance, or believing that a spouse is unprepared for marriage. And it's not at all surprising that even though we have about a 10% higher rate of marital satisfaction compared to the general community, there's still a pretty high level of fighting and disagreement that's going to make the reality of working together as a team with something as stressful as end of life substitute decision making, it's going to become much more difficult. Next slide. Okay, the default setting is to think that all families are like your family of origin. The reality is that every family is different, and the one spouse's family almost by definition will seem different. I used to have a professor who would say, there are two kinds of people. There are normal people and people I know. Almost everybody has challenges in terms of realizing that as time moves on. The key is not to see this as better or worse, rather as variation on the theme of normal. And once you pathologize this difference as a defect rather than a difference, there's very likely to be defensiveness and escalation of conflict, especially in end-of-life substitute decision-making. It's almost guaranteed that it's going to happen. Next slide. Okay, there are cultural issues. So we know that, European Jewish families have a very different set of culturally based expectations relative to Sephardic families. I live in Great Neck in New York, which is a suburb about a 23-minute train ride from Midtown Manhattan. But we have many Sephardim here, and there's tremendous differences in terms of the way illness is viewed, the way these kind of challenges are viewed, and the way decision-making is made. And it's just important to make ourselves familiar with all of that. Next slide. It's easy to forget that in dealing with our parents, we have the benefit of learning to accommodate to their emotional needs and demands. But often our accommodation to their personality, so much a part of us, we don't even realize how we have molded our behavior to minimize conflict and maximize effective communication. Okay, so that's that next thing. And the next point I wanna make, which let me just talk it out a little bit before we get to the slide, is the concept of disenfranchised grief, which I think is extremely important in these situations. Disenfranchised grief is, I'm sure many of us have who have experienced a direct loss in our families over the years, know what it's like to feel extremely close to a mother-in-law or a father-in-law who dies, and to feel that you don't really have a place, literally at the seat in the Shiva, that you feel sort of like disenfranchised, that there's no real place for you. And you feel a little bit out of it. And what often happens in substitute decision-making is that that's another source of tension, where if it's not handled artfully by the direct sons and daughters, the sons-in-law and the daughters-in-law are going to have that added layer of sensitivity. Okay, so that's something that I just wanted to throw out there, something that we have to keep in mind. Next slide. Getting used to different family styles. Next slide. The dimensions that families differ are pretty much on these dimensions. Hierarchy. Families are either, and this is in all the factor analytic studies of families, families are either rigid or chaotic. We all know that. Certain families are very Yekisha families. They're Germanic in their style. And I don't want to say this in any way that hopefully gets me and doesn't get me into any kind of trouble. But we all know, coming from a family, you know, a branch of my family has that kind of Washington Heights, you know, kind of, you know, if there's an appointment, my father's when I used to, when he was a Rav in Far Rockaway for over 65 years. And when he used to do a funeral, he would start exactly, it was an 11 a.m. funeral. He would start at 11 a.m. even if the mess wasn't there yet. He would just start, okay? He was a great guy, but he was extremely prompt about time. And what happens if you are in that family and you have a more of a relaxed style and you're not as careful about time? As he got older, he totally moderated and he learned how to not be that way, because marriage is a people growing machine and we learn how to grow as we mature. But at the beginning, we had those hierarchy differences. And those are often sources of difference and of conflict. And then the other factor that families differ on is intimacy. Enmeshed, which is put on a sweater, I'm cold, okay? You know, people where there's a blurring of the boundaries versus disengaged, okay? Where there's a, you know, you maybe hug your child once a year when you give him or her a bracha on Erev Yom Kippur, and that's it. Okay, or enmeshed, where you know you don't call at least twice a day, it's a problem. And families differ that way, and it comes out in a much more intense way when we're involved in an end of life kind of decisions. Next slide. Okay, and this I won't take too much time on this, other than the fact that chaotic families, you know, these are the kind of things that could come up even in decisions at this moment, like sense of time, sense of discipline, formality. Sources of such conflict might be expecting them for dinner and having them come very late or not at all. Just imagine when what you're getting together on is you know, in an ICU unit and you're trying to make decisions about, you know, about medical care, and you're fighting over, because there hasn't been clarity over what kind of rabbi to use and what's the role of the rabbi and what kind of, what's the role of the physician here. And, you know, all the things that we've been talking about all day. Okay, next slide. Okay, next slide. So this is the whole idea that on the intimacy dimension could cause problems regarding the psychological allergy to closeness brought about by end-of-life challenges and enforce time together, which can lead to feeling smothered. Keep going. A disconnected interpersonal style, which some people are just wired in a way that they're more distant. And that can seem uncaring to family members who, let's say, who you may not have had much to do with, and they may have been living up in Toronto, this was discussed earlier, and not had much connection for a while. And now there's other members of the family who are much warmer and closer. And the people often, instead of seeing those as differences, see them as defects, and it could trigger exactly the kind of tension that could get in the way of healthy substance care decision making. And remember that there are three words in the Sefer Hasidim written in the Middle Ages that captures everything. Acharis ketata charata. After argument, there's regret. Those three words, you know, really capture everything, but it's very hard not to have a collaborative atmosphere impacted by this. So again, it's why it's so incredibly important to implement the incredibly logical kind of recommendations made by Rabbi Dr. Sternberg in the last talk. Next slide. Next slide. Okay. Okay. This is all pretty much things that we could discuss in a discussion in a few minutes. Next slide. Yeah. The power of criticism, you know, the whole idea of nirganut, the debilitating impact of people being critical and not appreciative, not having the kind of hakarat hatov that's necessary to smooth over the inevitable conflicts is extremely important. And another thing to really keep in mind over here is the fact that there's a very people, over 90% of people, if you ask them, are you self-aware? In a large-scale study done by the Harvard Business Review a few years back, over 90% of people said, I am self-aware. Most people consider themselves to be emotionally responsive and self-aware. The actual reality is the polar opposite. Most people greatly overestimate their self-awareness. And the fact that Adam Karovets Latzmo gets in the way, and I'll end with the story of Illish. If we could go ahead a couple of slides and then with the concluding story. Yeah, by the way, just go back one. Yeah, the key is to validate without necessarily agreeing. And that's such an important skill to try to facilitate as members of the medical team in these in these situations. Keep going. There's research that shows that the more husbands accept their wives' viewpoints, the more she's able to accept his. The opposite, you know, it's just common sense. The Hebrew word ashrei is etymologically tied to the word yishur to validate. There's nothing quite as happy making as to validate somebody, for them to feel that you get them. Keep going. Okay, next slide. We already did disenfranchise grief. Rav Nachman says it beautifully. He talks about there's the tyranny of the shoulds that gets in the way of logical kind of decision making. So, so when Rav Nachman's chassidim come running over to him saying the misnagdim are saying terrible things about you, he answered, they have nothing against me, only against the person they think I am, and he deserves it. Okay. And we need to work on that cognitive piece. You know, we need to work on helping people self-soothe in terms of the way they think about things, remembering the Baal Shem Tov's, B'makom Shemal Shavto Shaladam Shem Hu Nimsa Ha'ish. The person is where his or her thought and thinking is. Let's keep going. Yeah. And I'm going to end with Illish and then a concluding story. This is Illish. Because Illish, this is the whole idea, is how easy it is for communication in terms of substitute decision-making at the end of life to get messed up by our own self-interest, especially if we feel that we're our perspectives aren't being respected. So the Gemara talks about the story of Rav Ilish. So Rav Ilish was, the Gemara tells us, was a man who spoke the language of the birds. He was an expert. He was the Dr. Doolittle of his time. And there's a beautiful thought by Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz about Ilish. What happened was, is he was thrown into prison. I think it's part of the Greek persecution. And with a non-Jewish person who also spoke bird. And a raven comes flying into their prison cell and screams to Ilish, run away, run away. And Ilish turns to his cellmate and says, what did he say? And he says, he said, run away. Now, so Gemara explains, you don't believe a raven. Raven are not such trustworthy birds. But then a dove comes in. And the dove says, run away, run away. And you could trust the dove. But before he trusts the dove, he turns to his cellmate again and says, excuse me, what did you just say? What did this dove say? And he said, run for your life, run for your life. Now Ilish runs for his life and is saved, okay? While the cellmate is executed. So the obvious question asked by Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz, but before that by the Vilna Gaon, is we know from many sources that Ilish was fluent in bird talk. Why did he keep turning to his cellmate to ask what he clearly knew? So quoting Simon and Garfunkel, okay? What the Gemara tells us is a man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. Ilish wanted nothing more than to be told, run away. He knew that he had negias. He had self-interest here. He wanted that more than anything in the world. He wanted to be told, run for your life, run for your life. And now that he keeps getting this back from his cellmate, he figures he better check. What's the take-home message for us? The take-home message for us is in dealing with something as emotionally provoking and as emotionally taxing as helping people make decisions about, you know, about something as sacred as dying in a way that's consonant with their wishes. It's something that gets to our core. And we're going to often be prone to hear what we want to hear. And what the Gemara teaches us is when you're not sure, ask. You can't do this alone. As we heard in the previous unbelievable lecture, okay, you have to ask. You have to keep on asking. If you're not sure, you ask. And I'll end with a story. There was a conference that I go to. I used to go to, I think it was every other year in Frankfurt, Germany. It was paid for by companies that benefited from slave labor during the war. And by German law, every few years, they'd have a conference to help meet the mental health needs and in general, the psychological needs of the ever-dwindling number of survivors there. And at the last conference, there was a man who had suffered terribly in Auschwitz. He was 15 years old when he was in Auschwitz, and he was the happiest man I ever met in my life. He had been through unbelievable exposure to death and to suffering. And he was filled with simcha, and everybody wanted to be around him, because when somebody is filled with simcha, people who are optimists and are able to squeeze growth out of suffering, right? As Medrash Tilim tells us, "Ilu nafalti lo kanti, ilu yashavti b'choshech lo hayarli." If I never fell down, I never would have gotten up. If I never experienced the darkness, I never would have experienced the light. So the conference goes on, everybody's hanging around this guy, and everybody's about to go home. So I go over to him. He'd been in many of the groups I ran there. And I say, listen, you're the happiest man I ever saw in my life. Yet you told me how you suffered in that horrible place. And he was a very articulate man. I say, where does the joy come from? So here's what he told me. It's sort of the image that I always keep in my head when I think about talking about topics like this. He said, I told you what it was like. I told you what it was like in sub-freezing temperature by the Nazis would force us to run out. And if we were too slow, they'd put the dogs on us. If we fell down, the machine guns would come out. And somehow I managed to survive through that and the death march that followed. I often wondered, why is it almost all of my friends didn't make it? And I made it. Where did that come from? And he said, I developed the ability to feel the warmth of my father's hands on my head when he benched me every Friday night. And to smell the sweetness of his breath when he bent down to kiss me. That's the ultimate image that I have when I think about this topic. It's the power of connection. It's the power of love. I'm just so proud of everything that we stand for and everything you all stand for in terms of what Jewish medical ethics is all about, in terms of the sanctity of every soul, regardless of intelligence, regardless of so many of the other kinds of things that can happen to us in life. And I think that that image of the connection and the hug and the bracha is the one that's ultimately what I think is what the substitute, intelligent substitute compassionate decision-making is all about at the end of life. Thank you, everybody.
Wow, thank you very much, Rabbi Pelkowitz. Once again, compelling stories and very moving. I'm going to open the floor to the chat for some questions. In the interim, I wonder if you can speak to the concept of, you spoke so beautifully about the family, the dynamics. What about the individual, the person burdened with this decision and the guilt that comes with it? I wonder if you have any comments, insights, or stories for that.
Yeah, I mean, if I, just to talk about whatever insights I might have, I often have a tremendous amount of empathy for only children who have to go through this. You know, when you have siblings who, in spite of all the tensions that come with this, are able to be together. You know, there's that great story that I, that great study that I love quoting, where they take people and put them at the bottom of the hill. And they say, estimate the steepness of this hill. If you're alone, most people estimate the hill as being very steep. The closer you feel to the person at your side, the less steep the hill looks and the less tired you get walking up the hill. Tova Mishnaya Minachas, right? It's we need to be, you know, having siblings at a time like this is amazing. And that's why I think the most important thing we could do when you're dealing here with the individual who doesn't have siblings, and I'm not even sure if that was the intent of the question, but somebody who's alone, is to make sure to make sure that you could help them recruit a support system. And, you know, it's at a time like this, you know, I often hear this when I'm, let's say, at a High Lifeline retreat for families of children with cancer. And I see people there who don't have siblings necessarily, and they're all alone with it. They often have to be taught and helped to understand that there's no greater chesed you could do for somebody than to allow them to give to you. And that's actually, you know, the research on that is very compelling. You know, it's literally a gift to somebody to give them the chance. You know, the word natan is a palindrome. It's the same forward and backwards. And I think that that's a... that's something that often needs a conscious kind of work with people to teach them how, as what is it, Arnold Schwarzkopf, the general in charge of, one of the last wars, says you can't help people get to the top of the mountain without your, climbing yourself, without your getting there yourself. So there's no such thing as effective, effectively helping a person without that connection. Does that kind of answer it? Is that responsive, Ian?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, especially the insight about the an individual on his own or her own. We have time for some more questions. There's a question here. Study families and SDM of loved ones who are in an ICU and decisions have to be made. The families report symptoms of PTSD after the death of a loved one. Have you seen this, and how can the medical team ameliorate it?
Yeah, so sure. PTSD is what I spent most of my career, working on and researching. I was on the DSM committee that developed the fourth iteration of the PTSD diagnosis. And we actually saw particularly high levels of PTSD with people who were exposed to, these kind of, actually, when we got involved at the beginning, you weren't allowed to get PTSD to medical stressors. And they agreed that if we could prove otherwise, they would change the diagnosis. So we did a series of three studies looking at this, looking at exactly what you're talking about, where we showed definitively that people do get PTSD to the diagnosis. They get PTSD to exposure, to the kind of things you're exposed to in ICU. And some of the things that are most protective are everything that we're talking about. It's being able to name the monster, being able to not be alone when you talk about it, being able to get support and to digest it a little bit at a time. There are specific treatments for this, for medical PTSD, many of them coming out of the University of Pennsylvania. There's some really important work coming out from a number of centers around the world showing that the essence, look, with the tragedy in Florida, in Surfside, what is becoming very clear there is the importance of the sense of community, the sense of being able to talk about things, and to feel that you have somebody with you at the bottom of the hill. All the things that are good for almost everything we've been talking about today are equally helpful over here.
Thank you very much.
Oh, one more thing. Obviously, to the extent that physicians can help with exposure, in other words, there might be some ways of giving support actually in the ICU, minimizing unnecessary exposure, if that's at all possible, that can make a big difference. So one of the most upsetting things I've ever experienced was I had a great nephew who had uncontrollable seizures, who was in a pediatric ICU in Israel. And he was, he ended up having terrible exposure to kids dying, and they weren't at all sensitive in that ICU to the impact on a little kid of seeing this, and it impacted on him as he was growing up. Today, thank God, he's doing much better. He responded to surgery and all that, but it's just so important to be sensitive to all of that.
Okay. So thank you so much, Dr. Pelkovitz. Really a pleasure. And again, once again, so insightful in this really difficult type of topic. I want to just thank all the attendees. We're going to close the session now. Again, a reminder that CME credits are available. Log on to the Torrin Motion website and fill it in. The Canadians will be a little bit more familiar with some of the format because it talks about the CanMeds. If anybody that doesn't know what I'm talking about with CanMeds, do not worry about it. Just call yourself a medical expert or a doctor. It makes no difference for those of their Americans. It's just a protocol of the Canadian Royal College where we get our accreditation. So just please fill out the form. We look forward to having everybody come out this evening at 7 o'clock. It'll be Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman who will speak to us. It should be a fascinating talk for anybody who has heard Rabbi Reichman before. He is one of the most creative and innovative speakers. And when he is planning something for the bar mitzvah, I have to say I'm personally very excited. It should be something very unique and exciting. And that will be followed by a very fascinating panel discussion, which will follow immediately after Rabbi Reichman. So have some lunch. The catering is, I don't know about that, but we look forward to everybody coming back this evening at 7 p.m. Thank you so much. Jay, anything?
Thank you. Thank you, Laser, for running a beautiful program. Your input and moderating and questions. Thank you very much. And thank you. Thank you, Dr. Pelkovitz, and a pleasure. And thank you, everybody online, for coming. And we look forward. I just reiterate what Leija says. And of course, this is like practice for next Sunday. Unfortunately, Tisha B'Av coming up, and we'll have a program from 11 a.m. Eastern through 7 p.m., 7:15, eight speakers in a row. That's a tough one. But okay, Tisha B'Av's a tough day, and you want to look to pass the time. So come. We have some three from Israel and the premiere. It should be a fascinating program. We, of course, all our programs during the week. I'll just mention tomorrow, Rabbanit Shira Mervis is beginning her five-part series on rabbis from the Islamic world. Tomorrow she's going to be talking about Rabbi Uziel. And that is tomorrow at 11, followed at 12:15 by Alex Israel's continuing series on the thought of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who goes through a different book every week. So that's tomorrow at 11, followed by 12:15, only 2 hours tomorrow. We'll look forward to learning. We have, of course, everyday learning, and look forward to seeing you. Everybody should be well, and please God, we'll see you back in five and a half hours. In 5.5 hours, pretty much exactly. It's 1:30. So please God, at 7 p.m. we'll kick off again. Okay, just have a wonderful day.
People asked about the PowerPoints. So yes, as soon as we get them, we will post them online, and they will be made available for the general public. Thank you again.
Yes, thank you. And what's for lunch? The staffers, that's whatever you guys make, but if you want, I can come over, and I don't know if I can come over, but okay, thanks a lot. Yes,
what are you yelling at me for?
I'm sorry. Okay, everybody be well.
Thank you. Some of us in Mariv now.
Mariv, okay, yeah. For those who live in Israel, listen, Lori Novick, who's speaking tonight, is in Israel. She's speaking from Efrat. She said she was honored to be asked to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to come and join the panel. So we figured that we didn't ask too many people from Israel to speak this evening, but figured it's always nice. So if you want to get up at 3 a.m, you're more than welcome. 2 a.m, really, for Eddie Reichman, and then 3 a.m. for our panel discussion. Okay. Go to sleep now. All right. Be well, everybody.
Thank you. Great program.
Okay. Thank you. Nice to see you, the Ammons. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Excellent.
Okay. Thank you. I know many of the people here, of course, have not been to one of our live conferences, and this is just really a small taste. Being live together, there's a whole, you know, obviously it's different, like everything on Zoom. What can we do? But it's substitute decision-making, I guess, if I can use that term. I hope I'm not inappropriately for the situation. And we'll see you all in a little bit. Okay. Where are you from, if I may ask, Mr. Blank? Where are you from?
New York City.
New York City. Okay, I heard of it. Yes. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. Be well.